So, welcome to our evening here. We're going to talk about IMC. And I've been looking forward to giving this talk since it first came up as an idea to give a kind of talk or presentation like this. And the reason I've been looking forward to it is maybe twofold. One is that IMC is something that I take a lot of delight in. It. It brings me a lot of happiness. And I've been quite surprised that IMC exists. I'm regularly quite surprised. I show up here and, what's this place doing here? And when I think about it, I'm just it's delighting, delightful. It's one of the bright lights certainly in my life that a center like this, community like this could come together. Something that I was kind of seeing kind of grow up from very little. You know, we used to be a small sitting group in Palo Alto. And I think the group, you know, started before me, and a little bit, maybe 20 or 21 years ago, I think is about the date, 1986, I think. So I thought it'd be really, I was looking forward to kind of just the happiness of kind of talking about something which makes me happy. And then the second thing that made me happy or about doing this was I was looking forward to finding out what I would say. So now we'll find out, all of us. What I'll do is I'll talk for a little bit, and then you can ask questions. Probably some of you have all kinds of questions about IMC and what goes on here and the philosophy that goes on here that maybe you've never had a chance to ask, and this is a chance to ask about it. I want to particularly welcome some of you who might be quite new here. Some of you I see have been here for a long time. But some of you might be quite new, and this is kind of your introduction to IMC. It has occurred to me that if this is a nice thing to do tonight, that this is maybe something we should do once a year, so that people who are new coming into our community could get kind of an orientation to what we're about and what we're doing that really hasn't been available in the past. So I want to welcome those of you who might be new and curious to find out what we're about. A little bit historical. Some of this many of you know because you've been around for a long time, but some of you don't know this, and so I'm going to give you a little bit of history. That in the very early 80s, James Berez and Jack Kornfield were both kind of in the Bay Area by that time, and together with a few other people decided to pursue the possibility of having a residential retreat center, which eventually became Spirit Rock. And they looked on a lot of different sites to buy, a lot of camps, places. And all of them didn't seem quite right. And then Jack Kornfield was about to, give up. Or they gave up. And as soon as they gave up, they got a phone call from the Nature Conservancy saying, yes, but we have this property. It happens to be down the street from your house. And Jack said, we're not interested. We're kind of given up. Oh, but you have to go look at this. It's a sacred Indian, sacred Native American site. So that was the hook. And so Jack went basically down the street from his house and was introduced to Spirit Rock. So there was this effort to kind of start Spirit Rock. By the mid-80s, it was kind of going along, and they hadn't found the land yet. And one of the people who was very active in that effort and very involved with Jack and everything was a man by the name of Howard Noodleman, Howard and Ingrid Noodleman. And they were the instigators for starting a sitting group in Menlo Park, I think around 1986 or so, 87. They met at the Valparaiso, the Catholic retreat center there. Anybody here there? Ursula? Ursula was there. So we've had some people who have been around for a long time, longer than me. And Howie Cohn, in the early year or two, was one of the main teachers who would come down to teach. And then at some point, I don't know why, the group had to move to Palo Alto. And so when I came to study at Stanford in 1990, I was studying at Stanford, but I was also in teacher training with Jack Kornfield. And one of the homework assignments from Jack Kornfield was to be trained, as a part of training for teacher, is to lead a sitting group. And it just so happened that, unfortunately, that Howard Noodleman discovered he had cancer, and he could no longer lead the sitting group. And he called me up and asked me if I would take it over. And so I came in September of 1990 or so and started leading the group. And at that point, it was about, it's my memory, it was like 15 people or so who came on a somewhat regular basis. And we met in what was kind of like a nice little living room of a church on Cowper in Palo Alto. And in the first, it was very simple in the beginning. And I would show up and teach. And I, as kind of continuing kind of the training that I'd gotten in Buddhism, certainly the training I'd gotten in Zen Center of San Francisco, and also the training I'd gotten a little bit in Asia, a person shouldn't want to teach so much. A person doesn't take the initiative to teach, but rather a person waits until they're requested. People ask you to teach. And so I would have been asked to come and teach this group. And so I kind of treated myself as a kind of like a guest, you know, kind of like I'm there under request. So I would come and teach. And it was very, you know, it was pretty nice. I was a new teacher and pretty new to it all, trying to make sense of it, what you know, make sense of teaching. And then there was a little basket for taking in some money to help pay for the little incidental expenses they had. I think there was a little bit of rent they had to pay and a few other things. And so I taught, and after I taught about 9 months, they had a little bit of surplus in that basket. And then it occurred to them to give me $100. And because it hadn't occurred to me or anybody that I should receive anything for teaching. I just taught. It didn't occur to me at all. So I was, oh, look at that. That's a surprise. And I didn't do anything. I had this idea that I'm not going to do anything here unless it seems like there's a request from the group. You know, that I'm here kind of like a servant of the group kind of thing, more or less. And we organized a one-day sitting that James Perez came down and taught. He was a Vipassana teacher in Berkeley. And it was a great event. There were some 80 people who came. It felt like a big event, you know, 1991, I think, spring of 91. And then it occurred to the group or me that maybe it would be good if I also led a one-day sitting. So then I started leading one-day sittings periodically. And after a couple of years, we started growing and growing in that little room. And when we got to be about 40 people, we were pretty packed, in this really packed in this tiny little room. And this man came up to me and said, "Gil, I'm a member of the Friends Meeting House, the Quakers in Palo Alto. Why don't you come and take a look at that place and see if you'd like to move the group there?" So I went and looked at it, and it seemed great. So we decided to make a move. As soon as we kind of announced we're making the move, the minister of the Presbyterian church we were in said, "Wait a minute, you can't leave us." one of the ministers, "You can't go. They liked it. They wanted us there. You know, sitting group, if you wanted the assistant minister wanted to come sit with us." And he tried to convince us, "We'll give you the bigger chapel." But we moved. What was remarkable was as soon as we moved, it seemed like we went from 40 to 60 people very quickly. Somehow the news of the move kind of let us grow. And I continued teaching there. And at some point, it felt like kind of a fantasy or a fiction. The idea that I was just a servant of the group who just did things when things were requested. In the sense that the group is growing big enough and active enough that, in a sense, without it being said to me explicitly, the request was for me to take some leadership of the group, to me to kind of take some leadership of the situation as a teacher, and that I shouldn't just kind of be waiting until someone asked me to, you know, teach a one-day sitting or something. That I actually, the group didn't. It was kind of a headache for people, right? You know, they always come to me and ask, and I should kind of take some initiative and kind of plan and organize. And I felt that was in some ways appropriate because one of the roles of a teacher is to have a sense of the potential that people can grow into, both individuals and also a community. And I had been around Buddhist communities for a long time, had practiced longer than most people in the group. And so I had a sense of the potential there, and I felt it was my responsibility as a teacher who had been invited in to try to open the doors, open the pathways or the gates to those fulfilling those potentials, so people can grow and develop in their spiritual life. And so it felt like I should, you know, get a little bit more involved than I had been. And so then, and we kept growing, the numbers kept growing. And at some point, in order to take the pressure off the Monday nights, we started a second group on Thursday evenings. And I explicitly wanted the Thursday evening group to be more for people who were newer to practice. It wasn't exactly a beginner's group, but what I often said was, here's where we're going to teach kind of the real basics of practice. Monday night, it could be anything in the Buddhist universe that I could talk about. But on Thursday night, it's going to be real practical and kind of down to earth. And also, because it was already a lot to teach more than one evening a week, I also said, I won't prepare for Thursday. I'll just show up. And it will be... And then we started teaching Thursday, Thursday I was just really content and happy that the teachings were very basic and that people somehow would help them manage in this life just a little bit better. It wasn't, some great idea of liberation or something that I'd be more interested for Monday night. And I was just happy that people could use the mindfulness practice in various parts of their life. It was very nice for me to have these two different formats. It may be nice for the community. There are some people who gravitated more to Thursday. That worked well for them. The kind of ambience, the feeling, the tone of it. And some people worked really well the Monday. And then at some point, so I was surprised by all this happening. Because when Jack Kornfield asked me to, as part of the teacher training, to have a sitting group, I kind of went along with the homework. It was a homework assignment. And I was asked. What I thought I was doing was being trained to become a retreat teacher. That's really where the real practice is, the heart of the practice, the really real thing is, you know, to go on long retreats, and that's what I was going to teach. And it was nice to support a sitting group, you know, in urban life and all that, but, you know, I was being trained to be a retreat teacher. But what happened was that as, this group kept continuing and I kept being involved with it, I was very much... impressed and inspired by the level of commitment that many, many people showed to their practice and the seriousness in which they took it and the degree to which they were practicing so well in their daily life. And also I had a sense from my variety of different practices, backgrounds that I had, that there was much more to a Buddhist practice than what happens on retreat. There's practicing daily life, it's practicing relationship and work and livelihood in all the different aspects of our life. And a lot of these aspects don't get evoked when we're on retreat. So to kind of create a well-rounded practitioner, it's really important to have a sense that you're practicing in your non-retreat life as well. And so with all that, I began to feel that I wanted to, or that I had a commitment to this group. And initially that commitment took the form of, well, at this point, I can't just leave the group. I think we need to grow this group enough so I can invite another teacher in so I could leave. But I felt a real commitment to the group. But as the group grew and grew, I felt that commitment was greater. And at some point, some of us had a meeting at someone's house to talk about the future of our group. And it was decided in that meeting some point aim towards having our own own urban center, not renting anymore. And that was about 1995, perhaps. That were 95. And so there was a year and a half, I think, of committee meetings, putting together bylaws and everything, trying to decide the governance and how we should be organized ourselves. A lot of thought went into it. And then in 1997, we finally got incorporated. So 97 or January 98, we got incorporated. And part of the incorporation idea was to put together the infrastructure that would allow us eventually to be able to have our own place. And I remember when we started this process, maybe 97, 96, I said to someone, it will take us 5 to 20 years to have a place of our own. And I was more thinking the 20 years, you know. And, you know, and then we kept growing, and, it was, you know, the pressure at Monday nights was kind of big. So then we started another sitting group on Sunday mornings in Portola Valley. And that slowly grew as well. So we had two sittings a week at the Friends Meeting House. We had one sitting a week in Portola Valley. Once a month, we had one-day sittings at the St. Mark's Episcopal Church in Palo Alto. And back then, maybe a couple of times a year, we rented Jokoji, a retreat center up in Skyline, to put on short residential retreats. So we were renting facilities in four different places in the course of the year. And then at some point around that time also, someone very generously, a friend of a Sangha member, offered me a small office, or it was a bedroom in her home that had its own entrance, and it became my office in Menlo Park. Before that, I would have interviews with people. People wanted to talk with me about their practice, and I would meet them, and when it was warm enough, I'd meet them in parks. You know, we sit in the park bench or in the grass. And when it was cold, we would meet in places like Cafe Verona in Palo Alto, or these different coffee shops. And sometimes people would be having interviews with me, and they're crying, you know. You know, and just, the waiters are looking, can I help you? And so, not having an office was a little bit awkward. And so it was very nice to have this office. And so we had all these places kind of spread around, all these things we were doing. And then we got incorporated around 98 or so. Then we started our fundraising. And the fundraising went relatively well. And eventually we had this wonderful situation where these ministers who owned this church here wanted to sell it to us. And they made we had a wonderful connection with them. And they made it relatively easy for us to buy this place. That's a little bit the historical background. Been part of my job ever since, all along, to be a little bit a visionary. Or not visionary, maybe not the right word exactly, but to be someone who has some sense, not just what's happening here and now, but has some sense of what's possible. And then not to be I don't like being the leader for moving into that, but I like being the person who kind of points to that possibility and other people take the initiative to step into it. There was a period of time where I felt I took the leadership for getting our own center, a short period of time. It was very gratifying. At some point, I was able to step back and there were other people who took leadership of it. And I was part of the team effort to do it. But there was wonderful people who stepped forward and really took a lot of leadership and initiative to kind of grow and develop IMC. But still, part of the teacher's role is to have a sense of vision and possibility. As the community has grown in maturity, then there's other people now also who are beginning to have some sense of potential and also sharing in that kind of planning and developing of the center. A couple of years ago, after we moved in here and things had gotten to a certain level of growth and stuff, I said to the board, basically, that's enough. Let's just stop and kind of rest for a while. Just what we're doing just fine. We don't have to grow anymore now. And we just kept growing. You know, there's this kind of, I think, almost a natural momentum of growth because it's in a spiritual practice, in a religious practice, people are growing and developing themselves. And that's what's supposed to be happening. And so as individuals grow and develop, it makes sense to have new opportunities for them, new ways of expressing their growth and maturity, and new programs and things. And so it makes sense. There's a certain kind of natural momentum to grow and develop. And in the last years, I don't know if how much we've grown in numbers in terms of how many people come here, but I feel really delighted how much I think we've grown in maturity, because I see a lot of our community and we've gotten more and more involved and more developed and grown in their way. So when I was kind of beginning to take some responsibility for this group in the early 90s, there were several decisions or choices I made that I think had a big influence on kind of the culture of the Dharma here that we have. One of the things was that very early on, in the very beginning that I was involved, I felt it was very important to give people who practice in a practice place or with a practice community the opportunity to take responsibility for the stewardship of where they practice. And I worded it very carefully. I wanted people to have the opportunity to take stewardship, the opportunity to take responsibility, to offer back and support and help create the community they're practicing in. But I didn't want it to make it an obligation for people. I didn't want to have a sense that you have to do this. So there was this kind of this art between making an opportunity without making it feel like some obligation or burden. And so whenever there was something to do, even if it was very simple, I would ask if there's anybody who would like to do it. So there were some simple things like we had, three or four different flyers we would put out every week, not for ourselves, but for Spirit Rock. We carried Spirit Rock pamphlets and stuff, brochures, flyers. And so I would ask, it was easy for me to carry. I could just fit them inside my little notebook. There weren't so many. And I would ask, does anybody like to be the caretakers of these and carry them back and forth every Monday night and put them out? Someone would offer. And would anybody like to be the person that opens and closes the door? I could carry the key. It was pretty easy for me to do it. But I just thought it was nice to give people the opportunity to feel like they're sharing, taking care of the place they're practicing in. And that sense of giving people the opportunity to help share and take care was part of a very important part of what we're doing here. The other thing that was important, similar to this, was the idea of dana, of generosity. How I interpreted this and how I've understood it is to offer, primarily to offer the teachings and the practice opportunities freely. That's what comes to mind first when I think about dana. So we're offering ourselves freely. We open the doors, we teach freely, without really any expectation in return. And so it's an act of generosity. And one of the reasons for that is that I think the Dharma practice, unfolds healthiest when it's in a field of goodwill and generosity. The relationships are somehow more conducive, I think, to Dharma growth when there isn't a kind of obligatory exchange that can happen when you pay a fee, for example, or is an expectation of some kind of exchange. It's just kind of freely given. And in fact, that's kind of pretty much our commitment ever since, is to do that. We have been very low key about this whole, about this, especially in terms of letting people know that they could make a donation in return. Those of you who come regularly, when's the last time you can remember that I gave a little dana pitch about how you can make a donation here? Who can remember the last time I done it? That's some. No one remembers the last time I did it?
It was a Saturday, I think.
Yeah, there was a Saturday. There was a Saturday a few months ago. 2002. So yes, 2002. So 2012, we'll get around to it again. And I actually do it somewhat regularly in that I do it the first day of the introductory class. People then are considered new to IMC, that he has to let them know what's going on. So at least two or three times a year in that form. Now, this idea of dana is a very important one for our tradition because, and then I'm a little bit repeating myself, the idea is that the spiritual life that we're living, practicing, unfolds best or it's nourished really wonderfully when it occurs in a field, an atmosphere of goodwill, generosity, and gratitude. And goodwill, generosity, and gratitude cannot be bought. And it cannot be an exchange, exactly. And Dharma practice is a voluntary thing. No one can really demand that you practice. Follow that breath. Yeah. Be kind, right now. No, people can teach you the basic ideas, but no one can really, you know, make you do it. It's a voluntary thing. Even if you paid for it, it's, you know, for the teachings, it still is a voluntary thing whether you do it. So I think there's something very nourishing when the whole field, the whole organization, the whole community, it really feels like that the whole thing is voluntary, and really points to this role of generosity and goodwill and gratitude. Maybe naive image or hope is that someone who comes new to IMC would come in and not notice the Dana box, and no one would ask them for any money or for anything, really. And some people come to me and say how wonderful it is to come to our community and be able to sit quietly, you know, in the back for months or years at a time, and it's the only place in a public kind of sphere where they can be with people and practice with people, and nothing seems to be asked of them. And for some people, it's really valuable for them to have that anonymity, that kind of being left alone. I know for other people, it's a little bit the opposite. They want community, and sometimes we're sitting here silently together, and where's the community? Sometimes it could be slow to kind of develop the community. So my naive vision idea is that someone comes here for a few months, and you know, there's no request for money given at all, and it doesn't even occur to them that money's an issue. And then after being here for maybe, I don't know how long, some months, it finally dawns on them, what's going on here? And then they kind of notice, or ask someone, or someone says, oh, it's all offered freely, and if you want, you could make a donation back, but it's generously freely given. And somehow that awakens some spark in them of appreciation of a different economic model than what's common in our society. One that's founded on goodwill and generosity. And perhaps it touches some part of the heart where there's a lesson, a teaching there about the role of these kinds of values in our lives. A very important part of this kind of volunteer generosity system is one of the volunteerism here at IMC. And I feel it's an art, a delicate art, the whole thing of volunteering at IMC. I still feel, as I did the first years, that it's very important to provide people the opportunity to be able to take responsibility, stewardship of the community they practice in, the opportunity to offer back in some way through their efforts to the community they practice in. But I don't want that to be an obligation. So for some people, for their life circumstances, that's the right thing to do. For other people, for their life circumstances, that's not right to do. And for people whose life circumstances such that spending any time, I mean, just getting here to sit for 45 minutes or come for Monday evening is a huge stretch in their life. They have kids, they have work, they have all kinds of demands, they're taking care of someone sick at home or whatever. And we don't want to give the impression to those people that, you know, in order to be a kind of good member of IMC, you're supposed to volunteer or anything. But it's for those people who'd like, and who it works, the opportunity is there. And one of the big surprises in my life is how well that has worked. How amazingly many people have stepped forward to take initiative and volunteered. And I was amazed a few years ago when I was told there were 75 volunteers. And lately, Inez, who counts these things up, told me there's 150 people. And that's a full range of people who do as much as Inez on one end of the spectrum, and then to people who maybe, you know, do something much more simple, or something that takes a lot less time. But the whole range, 150 people. I can't believe it. I don't believe it. Show me that list. He's right there. And it certainly warms and inspires me that there's so many people who will come forward in that way in their own initiative and want to kind of offer something to this community, support it, make it happen. So this idea of this community, the practice here, the teachings being made available freely without obstacles for people, translates in other ways as well. One is an attempt not to have Buddhism stand in the way of people's involvement with the practice we offer. As many of you know, some of the practices we teach here can stand quite well independent of Buddhism. It doesn't need Buddhism. Mindfulness doesn't need Buddhism. Buddhism needs mindfulness. But mindfulness does not need Buddhism. So there's a lot of people who, for whatever reason, are committed to another religion or not interested in so-called religion or Buddhism, but are very interested in some of the practices, some of the cultivations that goes on here, and some of the teachings. And it would be maybe a turnoff if it was all this was couched in very powerful Buddhist terms. So, for example, we could have had a much more grand Buddha statue here. You know, some gold, you know, big altar, and towering above us, you know, 10 foot tall, and every time we all came in, we had to get down on the floor and bow to the Buddha statue and offer incense, and we could have done that. That's the kind of Buddhist thing to do. Many places, Buddhist centers, you do that. But that's a rather Buddhist thing to do. And so someone who wants to come and learn about mindfulness practice might find that to be a turnoff. The idea was to make these teachings and this practice opportunities available to people, so there's very little obstacles to come and get it and receive it and to be part of it, participate in it. And part of that is that I believe it's a Buddhist value that any reduction in suffering is worthwhile. So the fact that someone is stressed at work and learns that meditation reduces their stress, I'm really happy. Or that someone is in a difficult relationship and they learn some basic principles of right speech and that helps the relationship, I'm really happy with that. I'm happy with small little help that people get. Regardless if they're, I don't care if they're Buddhists, you know, becoming a Buddhist is not very important for what we do here at IMC. Sometimes I joke that we're kind of like the Unitarians of the Buddhist world. However, Buddhism and being a Buddhist for some people is very important. It's important for me. And it's very important for me, and I believe, you know, for IMC, to those people who are interested in the full depth of what Buddhism has to offer, all the way to liberation, that also those teachings and opportunities get provided through us as well. So the art of IMC is, for better or worse, is to be something for everybody. Is to somehow be able to be a place of people, urban retreat center, where people living the stresses of urban life can feel like they can come in a relaxed way, comfortable way, come, and it helps them manage their life a little better. And that people who want to dedicate their life, perhaps, and really be engaged in some full-time way or complete way, or this is the central thing of their life is the Buddhist practice, that somehow we can support that as well here at IMC. And I've been pretty gratified that we've had the full range of people here practicing at IMC. We've had people certainly who come here because it's just a great help for their lives. Some people, you know, simple things, simply coming. Some people just find it a refuge to come and be in a community like ours. And maybe they're not even interested in the practice that much. It's just nice to sit in a room with people like us, and just it's helpful. And I'm happy that there's refuge for them. And we've had people who have gone off to Asia to become monks, you know, and sweated it out there. Monks and nuns we've had, and people who have gone off to Asia, and for example, long retreats. People who've gone off to IMS or Spirit Rock and sat long retreats. People who really made the practice kind of their central issue of their life, put everything else aside. Some of them have given up their regular kind of employment, simplified their life so they can really make this their, you know, their thing, kind of like pseudo-monastics in their level of commitment. And it's been really inspiring to me to have such people around IMC, involved with us and supporting us. And I think those people kind of nourish all of us for their practice and their what they do. So that's part of the art of IMC, is how to kind of cover this wide range. and to both be kind of Buddhist light, but also for those people who want to go Buddhist heavy, that there's a place for them too. And as some of you know, there's this writing on the wall up there that I asked Stephen Browning to paint after him, and it was meant to be fainter than it is, and so and actually a little bit higher than it is. The idea was that none of you would ever see it, and I would never point it out, you know. what it says is just kind of, at the time, was my kind of, I had some kind of heartfelt connection to this particular synonym for the for liberation or nirvana or nibbana, amata dhatu. And the idea is that whoever sits in this seat here would always be always see that and always be reminded that no matter how Buddhist light we are in our teaching, no matter what, you know, that we always remember that the teachings we do here incline, it's a very important word, incline towards liberation. So liberation is always there, kind of in our mind. So I'm not going to forget it, but it's always, that's kind of always the potential, the possibility that this practice is where it's going, which can go, and that a very important role of anybody who sits in this seat up here is to keep that in mind and kind of not necessarily talk about it every time or, you know, make a big deal of it, but at least kind of have something that points in that direction or leans in that direction or keeps that possibility open, so that people really feel that's a possibility for their lives. Liberation is a possibility, and sometimes it's hard to believe that, and sometimes, you know. So the idea of liberation, you know, is really important for me. If I wasn't didn't think that I was supporting people, encouraging people towards the Buddhist teachings of liberation, the Buddhist experience of liberation, then I wouldn't be satisfying to do this kind of work that I'm doing. But if I only taught those people who wanted, you know, liberation or bust, that wouldn't be satisfying for me either. And partly that is because I don't want to bifurcate life between what's, you know, acceptable and not acceptable, and what's right or wrong, or what's, you know, I want to have a priority or hierarchy of what's, you know, of practices and what's better practice and worse practice. Part of my understanding of the Dharma is not to do that, but rather to meet each moment and each person where they're at, in their fullness and completion of that person. And if what that person needs is a band-aid for the splinter, that's the full and complete Dharma for that moment. And that's what to do. If what someone needs is a little nudge into nirvana, then, you know, that's the Dharma of the moment. And the Dharma of the moment, we meet the moment. So you know this Zen expression that says, that all kind of a little bit misparaphrasing it, the essential teachings of Zen or Buddhism is can be summarized in the idea of an appropriate response. So to meet each thing, each person, each situation with respect, with dignity, that each person, each event, each thing is the Dharma is found right there and then. Part of that notion also goes into play with a certain view of mindfulness that I hope that I would like to develop here at IMC. And that is that there's two sides to mindfulness practice. There's a side that mindfulness practice involves connecting to this moment right now, being present for this moment right now. And there's a side of mindfulness that doing that is also a stepping stone on a path that leads someplace into the future. There are some people who emphasize a lot the value, the deep value, of just this moment here, waking up to this moment, being fully present for this moment, without looking into the future for some magic moment in the future when everything's going to be okay. Because if you have too much desire for the future or something, you'll miss this moment. But other people, there are other teachers who emphasize the importance of, you really need to have a strong sense of a goal and possibility. And unless you have that, you wouldn't have the motivation to really, and the skill, and make the choices that would really help you grow into the full potential of what Buddhism has to offer. And so, and then there's sometimes this conflict between the two schools, the present moment people and the future moment people. You know, the people who use mindfulness now and the people who are about using mindfulness for some great goal in the future, you know, the Big Bang theory of enlightenment. And I don't think that tension or conflict between them is necessary. I think they're both very profound teaching. And they're not, in conflict with each other. They're both true. And both can be developed. And I think it's very important to develop a sense of both. Because if you do, then you'll be happy with every moment of mindfulness you practice, regardless of where it leads. And you'll have a sense of how you're part of a path of growth and development that can lead to radical transformation. Both can go together. I've known people who've gone after the radical transformation path, you know, the thing in the future, and they haven't been transformed very much. It didn't work very well for them, and they ended up being bitter, angry at you know, all that time they spent being mindful. It's very sad, because they hadn't learned the great value that one moment of mindfulness has. It's wonderful in itself. Something comes to the completion in that moment. So you'd never feel frustrated or feel bonkers. That was a waste of time, because it was right for that moment. So there's a kind of a sense here at IMC of, I hope, of kind of encompassing or harmonizing a range of approaches in Buddhism, rather than holding them in opposition with each other. Few more things to say. One of the values that I hold, and I've tried various ways to pass this on here, and probably haven't succeeded so well, and that is to have IMC to be a Dharma-centered center, as opposed to a teacher-centered center. And those of you who were around in the old days, remember how much I protested or tried to resist getting up on this platform, having this platform built. I did not want this platform here. We were back in the Friends back then. We took it with us. I used to sat on the floor, you know, and with everybody else sat on the floor. And I did not want to sit in this high place. You know, because it's bad enough in our tradition where we sit in kind of a half circle, you know, and all this energy and focus is on the teacher. I mean, it's not even focus, it's not the Buddha even, right? It's, you know, here. And that's bad enough. And then to be up on this platform, you know, and the projection and everything, it'll go on. So I was not happy, but anyway, they twisted my arm. And the basic argument was that people who couldn't see me, you know, I was on the floor and they wanted to see me, so... But the idea is to be Dharma-centered rather than teacher-centered, because that's something we all share in common. I have a relationship to the Dharma. I'm a Dharma practitioner. You're Dharma practitioners. The Dharma is the teacher for us. And the Dharma is discovered through our practice, and we practice together. And I tried, for example, in the first few years when we did the Wednesday morning sittings, I tried so hard, valiantly, to whenever we met Wednesday morning, for that group to always sit in a circle when we got together, to symbolize the fact that, you know, what teacher was in the center, but, you know, the Dharma was. And, you know, after a while, you know, every Wednesday saying, okay, everyone, get up and move, you know. No one learned. You know, no one, it was so hard. And then the numbers got bigger and bigger and just got too awkward. But it's something I hold very important, the idea we have the Dharma in common. The Dharma is at the center. And that's not teacher-centered. And a little bit along that line is that I don't believe that any one teacher, you know, has a monopoly on the Dharma. Or even better, I don't think any one teacher really understands the Dharma fully, in its fullness. And that, so it's very important actually for people when they practice, they might have a primary teacher they have, but it's very important to hear a lot of different expressions of the teachings and a lot of different sense of how people practice and how they've been changed and who they are. I think of, you know, I'm part of the Spirit Rock Teacher Collective. And that's very important for me because I have this cadre of colleagues who are my peers and, you know, and I'm accountable to them. And, you know, they'll call me on things. You know, so I've had some of my teachers say, Gil, you know, this and, you know, about you're teaching this or you're doing this. And you pay more attention or you shouldn't be doing that. And very few of you tell me that except get up, except, you know, get off the floor. And so I have this, you know, this collective of teachers, quite large collective of teachers and friends and people that peers, that's kind of behind me, kind of the invisible support for IMC. But also, like I think, like a Spirit Rock Teachers Collective, which is something like 19 teachers now. I don't think that any one of them has the Dharma, but it's a package. If you want the Dharma, you have to get the whole package. And some of them are really good in some areas, some are really good in other areas. There's some teachers who are really good at the domain of relationships. And other people, that's not their strength at all. And other people, their strength is, you know, samadhi practice. And other people, their strength is loving kindness practice. And so like it's a package. Then together we make a package, make a whole. So part of IMC, it's been very important, is to be able to have a lot of people coming through IMC to teach. So the people of IMC can hear a lot of different voices and encounter a lot of different embodiments of Dharma in the different ways that it manifests. The last thing that should happen is that that you should all look at me, who's the primary teacher at IMC, and assume that if you're going to become good practitioners, that you're supposed to end up like me. You know, you don't want that. when I was a new Dharma practitioner at Zen Center, Ed Brown was the main teacher, first teacher I encountered. And my assumption was that I was supposed to end up like Ed Brown if I practiced. And I went away for a couple of years and practiced on my own a little bit and thought, Ed Brown, you know, how he was and carried himself and was. And then I came back to Zen Center after a while, after a couple of years, and I saw some of the other priests there. I remember seeing Philip Whalen, famous beat poet. There was a Zen priest there, and he was having breakfast, eating a cereal and reading a newspaper. And what? That's not Zen. You know, that's not, you know, Ed Brown would never do that. Ed Brown would just eat his cereal, you know. And then I realized, you know, the point is not to be like Ed Brown. Ed Brown is one of my heroes. I love him. I think he's great. But the point is not to be like Ed Brown. There's something very profound about being yourself, not becoming someone else. So sometimes having a lot of different models for practice can actually help you become yourself. But if you only have one model, it's not, you know, sometimes it's not as easy. So here a lot of different teachings is also a very important part of what we are here, doing here. Part of it also is, I think it's very important for people as they develop in their practice to have the opportunity to share their practice back to others in the form of teaching. And so in the last few years, we've had a fairly large group of senior practitioners, actually many. And I haven't been able to give all of them opportunities, but I've certainly started to give some of them opportunities to start giving talks. I'm very glad that Don Johnson started Half Moon Bay sitting group, and there's a sitting group that we started many years ago in San Jose. And some of our senior students have been able to go around and start giving talks more. And it's a very important part of a growth. It's a wonderful way of growing in the Dharma, doing Dharma practice, to be in the position of supporting other people to practice and to be teaching and all that. And slowly we're also developing people who are kind of also becoming teachers in their own right. We have Andrea Fellow, who's a wonderful teacher, and one of the wonderful qualities that I knew that Andrea was kind of ready to kind of be a good teacher she wanted to do something here at IMC that I did not think was a good idea. And I gave her all the reasons why she shouldn't teach that and why she shouldn't do that. And she went ahead and did it anyway. That was great. That was, you know, that was really good, I thought. So I knew we were safe with her. And so it's really remarkable what's grown up here. It's really remarkable that we have such a large community of people who are interested in practicing. I find it quite remarkable how many people are really serious about their practice. It's really very, very central in their life. And I feel very committed to supporting that, and IMC is very committed to supporting that. I think there's a lot of room for us to continue developing in terms of offering programs and opportunities for people to grow in their practice. And slowly over time, I hope we can find ways to do that. I've been, as I said earlier, I've been amazed at how many volunteers we have. There's a whole way in which being volunteers is a practice in its own right. The kind of the volunteering at IMC, volunteering at any practice center, offers an opportunity for practice. It offers an opportunity to be in relationship with other practitioners, the community, and being in relationship, both for the good and the bad, for the difficult and then the joys of it, is very important. Some of the difficulties of being in relationship are a very important part of doing this practice. If your Buddhist practice community was only harmonious, you wouldn't have a chance to grow. So there's something also about being willing to be in a situation that sometimes has conflict in it, and then work it out, and try to work it out. And I hope that IMC, I don't expect IMC to be a place that has no conflict or no difficulty, but I do expect, we hope that IMC is a place that we're committed to hanging in there with each other to work through the conflict. We're a place that people are willing or feel safe to talk about difficulties they're having. And if they're not able to do it directly, like if they have difficulty with me or someone, we do have this never really publicized committee called the EAR Council, the Ethics and Reconciliation Council. That's three people who are highly respected in our community, who are available to help with some of the conflict and difficulties that might arise. And so Jim Podolsky is one, just over there. If you have a conflict with anybody but him. And Cheryl Hilton. And who's the third person? Yes, and Nick Bennett. Thank you. And but you know, one of the ways of practicing is to practice, to have the opportunity to practice together with people. And there's a lot of learning that happens in the conversations and the practicing and being together. And there's a lot of, inner joy that can come from knowing that you're part of a support team that's making it practice opportunities available to people. Nothing at IMC happens unless there's volunteers who are willing to help put it on. And there are all kinds of managers who come and do things that manage, and people who put out the newsletter, and there's, you know, all these different volunteers who do these things so that the teachings and the practices can be available. This amazing phenomena we have with Audio Dharma wouldn't be possible unless there were people who sat over there and recorded and edited and did all the web serve work for it and the websites and everything. And it's a phenomenal offering that we offer the wider world. How many countries now?
Over 80.
We have people downloading our talks from 80 countries in the world. There's something like, I can't believe it. You know, mostly I don't believe what's going on, even here at IMC. But there's supposed to be 500,000 downloads a year of our talks. 500,000 people. So there's more people who are part of our community in the cyber world than there are people who actually come here in person. So that's phenomenal. So as we continue to grow and develop, and you know, the potential and make more opportunities for people, it's not going to happen unless people step forward to volunteer. And there are times when people have done, many times people have done that completely on their own initiative. I've been delighted, especially when we first moved in here, to show up here, open the door, walk in, and find that somebody had done something that I didn't even know needed to be done. And no one had asked me. No one had asked anybody. They just went and did it. And I guess it could be a problem sometimes if you do the wrong things, but but this idea that there's a self-initiating people who took the initiative. And so my hope is that the people who come here regularly, and for those people who come regularly and who want to, that that they can feel like this is their home, their spiritual home. And in doing that, they can feel that they're welcome and encouraged to take responsibility for their home. If something needs to be done, step in and do it. There's no them there. There's no them at IMC. You know, it's us. And sometimes that there's no there is a problem, because sometimes things don't get done. There are certain things that maybe I won't mention it right now, but there are certain things which remain unfinished or undone, not done. And, you know, just waiting, and no one's doing anything. Just there. I walk by it every day, and still there. I wonder, is anybody, why don't I do it, I think. I see it. Well, I'm thinking of doing it. I have a sabbatical coming up, and I'll have time. I'll do it then. I'll take care of it. And but mostly it works pretty well. Part of the spirit of the volunteerism that I've tried to develop here at IMC is it also a delicate balance between we very, very much appreciate and value the volunteer efforts. It's really a marvelous thing that people offer what goes on here and makes it possible for people to come and practice and learn here. And this is the difficult part to say. I don't have to say it just right, but I won't say it right. Then we can go to the Air Council. But and for most of the things that get done, we don't need them to have them done. We don't need to have them done. So there's a great appreciation, but there's no need. Because we can collapse. We're a collapsible organization. We can become a lot simpler than we are. And at least in my mind, I would like to think of that kind of, that we're fluid. We're not trying to hold on tight to an institutional form. This is the way it has to be. If we don't have a newsletter, the newsletter comes out 3 months late. It's not going to be the end of the world. You know, I think I'd rather be relaxed. There are people, you know, a lot of people, Inez and Elena, who do fantastic work for us and help a lot of people through the newsletter that they do. It's really wonderful. But I don't think we need to get all tied up, wrapped up, and, you know, uptight around the newsletter. If somehow something happens and just, you know, not easy to happen 1 month, it comes out maybe a month later. So the idea is to kind of have this great appreciation and value for what people do, but also to hold it really lightly so that we can collapse and not do it. And so it's more fluid, more relaxed, and hopefully people don't take their volunteer work at IMC as a burden. Because if it's a burden, then it's one of two possibilities. If you feel as a burden, then that sense of burden is a great opportunity for you to practice. Or it's a sign that you stop doing it. You know, because we don't want that to continue very long. Now, this sense of this holding things lightly has gotten a little bit harder as we've gotten so big and so many volunteers. So we're going to try to caretake the whole volunteer scene better than we have in the past. And one of the ways to do this is that I'm going to offer a year-long program called the Dharma Volunteering that will start in April. We'll meet once a month. And anybody who's volunteering or is interested in volunteering at IMC can come if they'd like. And we'll have some practice together, and we'll have some discussions and teachings around and explorations of some of the different issues that come up around the practice of volunteering. And kind of gets, you know, to offer support and offer some depth and really kind of pass on the idea that the kind of volunteer work people do is also a practice in its own right. It's a form of Buddhist practice to do that. And so let's discover how that is and how to make it enriching it for people. As we've grown and gotten bigger, it's gotten actually much more complicated to hold the volunteer structure in place. And it's important to care for it well and have a good structure, because even though we want to hold things lightly, we also want to respect people's work and effort. And so respecting entails that there's a timely way of responding to people and supervising people or supporting people in the different things they do. And we've had in history sometimes of people falling between the cracks or something not being supported properly. So a few people have put a lot of work, thought into kind of creating a nice structure for how everything can flow together. And we hope it's kind of a fluid structure, it doesn't have to be locked in, but a structure that would help kind of support what we are. And you'll see there's handouts like this on the table, and also this big poster on the window there by the front door that lays out our current organizational structure. And it's organized with the board kind of being the main custodians of the place. And then the board has basically five groups kind of under it. And each of those groups has what we're calling a program director or director of the group. And those five directors and myself are kind of like a team together with the board that helps take care of IMCs and communication with each other and kind of exploring the Dharma at this level. And then under that, there's a whole slew of other committees that take care of so many different things that each in their own way is helpful for people, is helping people and helping our community. So some of you might be interested in volunteering. Some of you might be interested in exploring what's possible to develop, how to develop and use volunteering at IMC as a way of developing and growing. One of the surprises to me is that some of the people who've taken leadership positions at IMC, I've been surprised to see how much they've grown as practitioners, as people, as leaders in that role. And I've realized kind of after seeing that, that's one of the things we offer to people is a chance of that kind of inner development that allows them to grow in as a leader, as a person, in that taking responsibility and involvement in a community like ours. So I want to make that available to people who are interested and make it clear that that's a route that people can take if they'd like. They'd like to be more involved and grow in that capacity. And so maybe I should introduce to you our board. Those of you who don't know, there's Elena, who is the president of the board. Would you stand up so people really see? A wonderful president. And thank you. And then there is Claudine, who is our wonderful treasurer. We really lucked out with Claudine being our treasurer because she's a professional accountant. And I found out from her that there's much more involved I could ever imagine that we needed to take care of than in accounting than we had been taking care of. So now we have a really responsible, you know, accounting scene. And that's one of the few things we can't collapse. You know? And then we have Jim Bronson up here, involved with us for many, many years, is now doing teachings for us. Thank you. And so where are we going around? There's Nick Bennett, also been part of the board for a long time and helping a lot with the chaplaincy work here at IMC and pastoral care kind of things. And Chris Clifford here has been part for a long, long time. And the vice president, and she very fond of the many years in which she managed the Thursday evening in Palo Alto. She was there kind of opening and taking care of it and running it. And it was such a lovely thing for her to do and a lovely way for me to have contact with her. And then Jim Podolsky, been well for a long time, also gives talks here sometimes. And our newest member is Carol Collins. And Carol is leading up our efforts to find a retreat center for ourselves. And part of the vision of seeing the potential and the growth of our community and to really ensure that our community has places to grow and develop in our practice and deepen it in all the different ways is to have a retreat center where that's a whole new step and a whole new dimension of how people can grow and develop and a community can grow and develop is to have that. And so Carol's now, as of today, I guess, Susan Ezekiel, yes, and Bruce Friedman has been, thank you, is on the board. And he never thought he'd be a secretary. And now he's a secretary of the board. And thank you. And many wonderful people here. There's many former board members here who been involved since the very beginning. There are people who are involved in different committees. There's one of the kind of program or directors of these different five programs we have is here is Betsy Meehan, who's going to is offered to take leadership or kind of coordinate the efforts of what we call Sangha Care, the Sangha Care Group, that involves like Sangha neighbors and our ability to offer chaplaincy service. As our community has grown, one of the things... Am I boring you? I've just talked for an hour now. Maybe I should check in. I'm sorry. I didn't think I had so much to say. But at the risk of continuing, one of the things that became clear to me is that our community grew, that this is a primary spiritual community for many people. And so there are spiritual needs. What then maybe in the Western terms can be called pastoral needs, is something that needs to be met through our community. So there are people who want to get married, and this is their community. So, you know, you can't tell them, oh, you know, we don't do that. You know, just the Baptists down the street do it. people die in our community, and so it's appropriate when it's appropriate to offer ourselves as a place that people do memorial services for our community. I've done baby blessings. I've done a rite of passage for a 13-year-old girl going into that, you know, kind of, we called it a bud mitzvah. And we did another rite of passage into elderhood for Hilda just recently. And so there's kind of these are more kind of pastoral needs. And also there's people who get sick and start dying and all kinds of things happen to them. And one of the things that became clear was I didn't have the ability to be present for all these people in the way that they really should be received support in. So now at IMC we've created a chaplaincy council. And these are people who I very much respect and value their maturity and ability, who are available now to do, to offer the kind of care and support that I think people in our community are warranted as appropriate. So already, some of our committee has been involved. There was a suicide that someone connected to our community had recently in their family, and so one of our chaplaincy council people went and supported the family for a while, and a variety of things that a variety of people who situations. We get emails from people because of Audio Dharma, people in some level of distress, and it's a little bit complicated how to respond properly to that. But we've had some success of some of the chaplaincy council people, supporting them and getting them on the right track. So we have this committee, and there's about 12 people who are available to help take some of that, to respond to some of that need. So it represents part of our growth and development as a community. There's a lot more potential that we have. As our community grows, I think that I'm hoping that we continue growing and filling that potential. And the only way that's going to happen is because people here step forward to kind of offer and support to make the whole thing go and offer and make possible to take care of the next steps and developments we need to have. Nothing needs to happen. We don't need to grow. But there's a great opportunity in the growth and a great potential for joy. I hope that those people who come to IMC, that one of the many kind of things that they encounter here, I hope they encounter joy. I hope that it brings them joy and delight. It's a bright light to come here and get a sense of what this community is about and the phenomenal goodwill that's here. And we don't have membership. That's a choice we made. So, but we do have membership. And the membership is made up of anybody who would like to be. And you're a member. And if you want to come all the time and not be a member, that's fine. and if you've never been here before and you feel like you want to be a member, you are. It's very, very relaxed that way. And I hope it's something that you find meaningful. I've talked a long time. I apologize. We can take a few minutes, perhaps, if someone wants to ask some questions of things that I've left out and things you've always wanted to know. And
I'm wondering if there are any satellite sitting groups, particularly in the Palo Alto area.
In Palo Alto, the closest thing we have is there's a woman who is connected to us named Julie Forbes, who has a sitting group that's like Wednesday at noon or something at Alvanitas, the kind of retirement community in Palo Alto. And then Shyla Catherine, who has is connected to us, she has her own sitting group, her own center, kind of sitting group in Mountain View called Insight Meditation South Bay, I believe. And then, you know, that's the closest that I know of.
Thank you.
Yes.
You talked about how you consciously like to combine or meld the Buddhist light with the Buddhist heavy. I have one question. From time to time, we might have some monks that come by and give talks, and that's wonderful. But they tend to be Western. And I know that there are a lot of Asian monks and nuns in this area and that are very wise and wonderful. I personally feel that we might benefit a lot from seeing it from the other perspective to have those teachers come from time to time.
Yeah, I agree.
Is that a possibility, or is that a conscious decision to not sort of have it too heavy?
No. I'm always delighted to invite Asian monks who I respect, I know. And it seems like probably, from the average, probably once every year or something, we have someone, an Asian monk, come. We had... maybe not that often, but it does happen periodically that we have them come. And but you know, I don't go out shopping for monks. I don't go out looking and recruiting. A little bit, partly I don't have the time of people I don't know, and so I feel, and sometimes not all monks are the same. So there are people who ask to come and teach here, and I don't really. I feel like I do a disservice to our community to have them come. So the whole question of, you know, I want to be very careful. So one of the policies I have about who I invite to speak here is only if I know them. And there is a possibility. We are trying to get a Burmese teacher here in June. Utejaniya, and it's a matter of whether he's a wonderful teacher, very popular at this moment, and he is. It's all depending on whether he gets a visa to leave Burma or come to this country, and we tried to get Usajiva, another wonderful Indonesian monk, to come and teach a retreat for us, but he wasn't able to with his schedule to come, and so certainly that's of interest for us, is to have Asian monks as part of it, monks and nuns.
How do people know what all the volunteer jobs are and how we can hook ourselves into them?
I don't know so well that answer. Who wants to answer that question? Inez, do you want to answer that question?
Well, since we're in the process of really reorganizing, we're actually going to make it a lot more obvious. Until now, it's really been when there's been a need, we've kind of like asked around. Sometimes we've put on the email list. Sometimes just tell people we know, you know, what's needed at the time. And often people just come up to me and say, you know, I'd like to, you know, I'm the managing director here at this point in time. And people just have come up to me and said, I can do this, you know. And we also have volunteer forms that people fill out, and they write down their skills And there's some by the door, by the way. And, you know, and so we'll look through those when we have a need. And, but there's always something that can be done, you know. I mean, there's always things to do here. So you could talk to me, you could talk to Audrey over here, and Jim Podolsky, and, you know, and any of the board members, actually. So, but it'll be a lot more obvious soon, because I think we're going to set something up that will kind of chart it out, and it will show what things are needed. So, thank you.
I've sat in Zen.
Maybe off.
I've spent time in the various formal zendos, and I've always wondered why, if there's an etiquette here for coming into the meditation hall. I mean, I know that, you know, people don't want to have a lot of formalism, and, you know, I can come in and bow, you know, when I want to and things like that. But, you know, after the bell's rung, it really surprises me that people continue to come in. And, you know, if there could, that there's, is there any notion of etiquette within a meditation session?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I have, don't have any fixed views on this. That's why I haven't actually said too much about it. I have some views. But it's still kind of something I consider after, you know, we're 30 minutes into a 45-minute sit and four people walk across the creaky floor. I wonder if we should say something about that. And you say, you know, when you come that late, maybe you should sit out there in the outer hall. And, just, you know, I've wondered about that. The choice so far has basically been an etiquette-free place. So that, again, has to do with the accessibility, that that the place is quite accessible to anybody. People are new, and it'd be kind of a turnoff for some people to have it formalized. There's some difficulties with forms, some benefits in forms. And given the pros and cons of everything, the choice is made to kind of make it, keep it quite relaxed, and let people come and take whatever form that works for them. I think that, this is an urban meditation center. And given that people, the kind of urban lives that people live, it's a real challenge for some people to be able to come and to come on time, for example. And the fact that this is a place people can come at all, you know, I'm just so happy that, you know, they can come. So I don't want to say, well, sit by the, you know, don't come in or don't come late, you know, we'll lock you out or something. I just want people, if they're, you know, it's nice people come on time, but if people, I assume that anybody who's late is late for good reason. And that's my assumption. And so then, you know, let them come as an urban center. If we were a different kind of center, you know, we might have different kind of etiquette and rules. Also, you know, it's also the kind of part of the advantage of mindfulness practice. In mindfulness practice, there's no such thing as a distraction. Right? So we have a lot of room in our practice to incorporate everything as part of the practice. Yes. Robert in the back.
Would you talk a little bit about the vision that the IMC holds for the urban residential retreat center?
A little footnote before that. Perhaps it comes, I think, I kind of suspect that it comes with the kind of role that I've had for our community as our community grows. As our community has grown, I've been surprised to discover that I have more and more vision for our community. And I hope that that's the safe and appropriate thing to do. It seems like maybe that's part of the role. But, you know, 20 years ago, I never thought of myself as having visions for anything, you know. But maybe it comes with, you know, this kind of caretaking this role has. So my vision, one of the visions is, I have a lot of visions now. Visionaries are dangerous people. So you've been warned. But one of the visions is having a retreat center. And I think that a retreat center is a place, you know, in some ways, meditation retreats is one of the heart for the real depth of practice in our tradition. Not everyone, there's a lot of depth outside of retreat center. It's a very, like, great value outside of retreat center, retreat practice. But I think that the nourishment, the support, the health, the long-term sustainability of our tradition really comes out of people's ability to do long-term retreats, long-term deep retreats. It's a wish, a desire that I have to teach people on retreats. It's something that's I feel it's very important to be able to kind of work with people at that level and support people at that level and train people at the level of deep retreats. And I think it's something very maturing and very supportive for our community here at IMC in Redwood City to have a residential retreat center associated with us so that we're kind of in our orbit, in our kind of sphere, in our kind of understanding what we're about. Not that everyone or anybody has to go on a retreat, but that somehow I think having that in the atmosphere and associated with us actually will deepen everyone's practice, including those people who don't go on retreat or don't go on retreat now. And then having a retreat center is a possibility for not only silent long retreat practice, it's an opportunity for other kinds of practice programs as well that we can't do here. So, for example, we might be able to do special kind of modified retreats for beginners, kind of new introduction to retreats. We could do weekend retreats, we can do week-long retreats, we can do month-long retreats. We might be able to do study retreats. There might be, particular forms of study or practicing that's kind of unique that could only happen in a residential program. Study programs, for example. Stephen Batchelor can come and do a week-long study program. It would be very, very rich, enriching for us. Having a retreat center might also allow us to support the family program a little bit more. There could be family retreats that we do occasionally. They have a wonderful family program at Spirit Rock. It's a place where we can invite a lot of different teachers to come in. I'm not going to be the only teacher by any means at a retreat center. And there's a lot of wonderful teachers who would be nice to have part of our community. And one way to bring them in and really get the kind of the fullness or the depth of what they have to offer is to have them be able to offer their teaching in a retreat context. So to be able to have people come and offer retreats here would be really great and to offer to our community. The other thing about the vision for Retreat Center is that I think what we're doing at IMC, having an all-dana system, which everything's freely offered and freely supported, is a very powerful Dharma teaching, very powerful Dharma kind of situation that a lot of people around the country are actually watching IMC and are very inspired by what we're doing here. And there are different groups who have decided to follow our model because we've been successful in doing it here. So, you know, we've been kind of a model for other people. And I would, part of my vision is to have this, is to be able to offer the same kind of Dana culture on retreats. So be able to have that, the retreats also be freely given. You know, there wouldn't be any charge for the retreats. I think this is a very powerful thing to do and a very, very wonderful thing to do. It has its challenges to do that, of course, you know. But, it's been a huge challenge. I mean, people told me 8 years ago, there are people, you can't do that, Gil. You can't get an urban retreat center on the peninsula. No way. You just have some delusions of grandeur or something. And but now we do. And it's all on Dana, the whole thing, right? So I think it's actually to create this vision of part of the vision is to have this this retreat center is also in the same way, and I think that's a powerful thing to be able to do here in America. It's a powerful teaching. It's a powerful example. It's a powerful opportunity to practice within. Maybe a couple of more, and then we could stop. Yeah. Oh yes.
Thank you. I can't help but notice that there's no kids here. And I come from a, kind of a traditional church. type setting where you'd see like a Sunday school for kids. So does this not translate to kids, or how's that work?
There's a few things. There's a lot to be said about that. But we have over the years, but maybe 10 years now, some kind of family program for kids. We started it very modestly in Palo Alto, half an hour once a month, and then it kind of grew. And then, and now most months we've had a program last Sunday of the month. That's about an hour and a half long. That's somewhat developed, but it's kind of parent-led and parent-taught and everything. And some of the kids have been coming for a long time and involved with it. When I first did the family program are now in college, and it's kind of wonderful to see them growing up. And it was I think it was somewhat significant. You know, the suicide I mentioned earlier was the father of one of the girls who was in the first family program we started 10 years ago. And she was like 17 then. Okay, she was 7 then. And so I hadn't seen her for a number of years, but I went to see her after her father committed suicide. And we had this connection because she was part of the family program. It was very significant. So we've tried. One of the challenges with doing a family program here is aware. It's been a challenge because we've been told that a lot of parents would love to be able to have a place where they can leave their children so they can come for the practice and the teachings. But, you know, our building's not big enough for that. And we've tried to find facilities in the neighborhood here that maybe we could use for the family program. But we haven't found anything that's been suitable. And if we had a retreat center that might be in the right kind of place and location, one thought was maybe we could do some kind of, spill out and have a family program there. We are in the midst of trying to revamp or change the family program that we have, the kids program that we have, and to try to improve on it. So we'll see how that goes. It's just right currently changing. And now it's going to be, the bulk of it is going to be the first Sunday of the month between 5:15 in the evening and 7:15 in the evening. So people who come here normally at normal events won't see the kids, right? We don't know how many families there are who would come here, be part of us, if we had a much better family, childcare kind of system and kind of Sunday school kind of thing. If we had a whole other kind of facility so we could have a family program during the regular Sunday morning program, are there a lot of young families who would actually find this very beneficial? We don't know. We don't have the surveys to let us know. It does seem that the demographics of our community is the average age probably for people who come to IMC is somewhere between like about 51, 52 years of age, which generally means they've gone through that phase of their life of raising kids, and so that's not so relevant anymore. But it could be there's lots of kids, lots of young people who would love to come, but they can't because their family circumstance. So I don't know, is that an answer? Good enough answer? So also it depends a little bit on, again, we're all volunteer, right? And there has been some pressure, some interest from the parents who've been leading and organizing the family retreat, the family program here, to say, this is really hard to do, to organize this, we're the parents and all that, and we're doing it. And what we really need is to get someone who's a little bit more trained and, really can focus on, like, as a teacher for kids who really run it. And they said, well, I think what we need to do is we need to hire someone. And I said, well, that's interesting. We have to discuss that because we've made a decision very clearly at IMC not to hire anyone, not to have a paid position. Because I think then the whole volunteer thing that we are will then slowly change. And so no one gets paid here, including me. So I'm not on salary. I wanted to mention that to people. Some people assume because, this is my job, right, that I have a salary. And that would be the reasonable thing in America, right? But I don't. I do get some benefits from IMC. Like the IMC pays for my family's health insurance and life insurance and a few other things. But my livelihood comes completely from the donations that I receive from people, what people give in the, that Dana box. And so that's kind of interesting way of living. You know, it's kind of a little different. So in terms of family program, you know, so we could, you know, I didn't rule it out that we could hire someone, but it just seemed like it was a real stretch, and we had to do that very carefully. And we were worried what we'd do with our kind of culture of volunteerism that we have here. Anything more you want to ask or say about that? Because it's an important question.
Yeah. Related. How is that handled at Spirit Rock? Because they have a family program, right?
They have at least one person's full time paid to take care of it.
Full time.
It's a full time paid position to run the family program at Spirit Rock, and that person in turn might have a few other people who are paid as well, kind of part time. But it has a whole army of volunteers. It's a very complex program, and it doesn't pay for itself. And so Spirit Rock, there's a Spirit Rock, the Spirit Rock retreats you sit, for example, and there's a Spirit Rock financially supports the family program. And they put some really fantastic program. I was there on Sunday helping to teach the family program there at Spirit Rock, and it was an inter-Sangha family program, so we had families from our community here going up there, and we had some, like, I don't know, it seemed like 50, 60 kids running around the place.
Over 80 kids.
And Spirit, you know, so they have this wonderful, Spirit Rock has a wonderful family retreat during the summer. That's 5 nights. And it's an amazing event. Those of you who have been to Spirit Rock and have done retreats there and have been to that great, great silence, and those move in, you know, and you can't believe how still it gets and as peaceful it is, come to the family retreat, you know, and it's, you know, it's a whole different universe. So maybe that's enough. It's last one, Kate.
I think it might be a good closing question because it's been interesting to hear about the growth of the community, and I'm glad to hear we're being taped tonight because, you know, 50 years down the line, people are going to be interested in the history of our center, and I hope we're keeping some good, you know, copies of all the newsletters and things like that.
Great, yes. It's kind of very, very gratifying to me to notice that there are people who are inspired by what we do. And to some degree, in a small way, we're kind of pioneering. There are many people in America who are many groups who are pioneering what it means to be Buddhist group in our country and this country. And so we're one kind of pioneer, and I think that I'm very proud of what we've done. I'm very delighted, and it brings me a lot of happiness, and it brings me a lot of delight to hear the people around the country who look towards us and are inspired by what we do, and they're very grateful, and all the different people we support and help. I hope that all of you my hope is that you all find it valuable for yourself and your practice and your development to help others in their practice. That it isn't just a one-way thing, we're just your practice, but that there's a wonderful mutuality that as we practice, as we support other people to practice, it helps us deepen our practice. As we deepen our practice, it helps us to support other people in their practice. And it's really, you know, we all share the Dharma, and it creates a wonderful mutual interactive kind of field in which we all practice together. We're all members of it. We all helped create it. We all are responsible for it. So as we go along here in the next, you know, days and weeks and months and years, please feel free to talk to me or talk to some of the board members about concerns you have about IMC, questions you have. Please ask if you have any visions of what we can be about and how we can grow and the programs you'd like to see happen. Please speak to us and let us know. You're all part of the community, and your voices and concerns are welcomed. Those of you who would like to volunteer, we would like to make it as easy as possible for that to happen. Some of you might want to talk to some of the board members or Audrey or some people here today. If you look at this volunteer organizational structure chart that the handout, you get a little sense. It's more complex than it actually is shown on this chart, but this is already pretty complex. There's lots of room to volunteer, and in terms of what IMC needs the most at this point, even though we're not supposed to have any needs, is actually some people who want to take a lot of responsibility, who have the time, the ability, the interest to take a fair amount of responsibility, helping really coordinate and support a lot of other people and be in touch with a lot of other people and to be in touch with the board and with me, kind of with some of the sharing the responsibility of all this. So you can look at it, and if any of you are interested in helping this level, any level, and the thing that I value the most is not so much the volunteering, but I really value the fact that we can practice together. And it's a profoundly meaningful for me to be in a practice community and to be able to feel and sense and learn from the practice of all of you. And so it's a great privilege for me to be in this role. And I hope that we'll have a wonderful, practice community together for years to come. So thank you very much.